at what point did politics become a process whose only purpose was to serve itself?
Right.
At what point did the hammer start hitting things because it was a hammer, as opposed to put nails down in place?
Right, you
know,
that's
the thing. It's almost like, you know, capitalism and politics, these processes, we created them, I hope, to enable the betterment of society as a whole. And they then became things that we worship as gods.
Right, this is so true.
These abstract concepts became gods. It's like, sort of, it's like allowing a boat to sort of set sail. You sort of, you're there at the dock with your argument or your debate or your opinion piece, whatever it might be that you chose to publish in a blog, and you just push it out there, and you hope the sea takes it wherever it takes it. And you have no idea where it's going to end up. Yeah. You have no idea where it's going to dock. This is the thing. You have no idea where it will connect.
Hello, I'm Dave. I'm the guy that's putting all this stuff together.
I need to get better. Please make me better. I want to get better. Better. Better acquainted with you.
Today we're getting better acquainted with Musa Okwonga. Hello, Musa.
Hi.
This is going to be an interesting couple of answers to these first two questions that I ask everybody, so we'll see how that goes. So the first question that I ask everybody is, how do you know me?
From Twitter. You very kindly got in touch and you said you enjoy reading my work. It's very kind of you. And I think I might have mentioned a podcast or maybe doing one myself. And you were like, right. Oh, well, yeah, you could do one. And actually, well, why not just come on mine and have a chat?
Yeah.
So, and here we are.
And this is the first conversation that's been with somebody who I met so casually on Twitter. I've had somebody who I developed a long-standing online friendship with, and then they've been on, but you're just somebody who I sort of like reached out to like with one tweet, like basically, and this happened. But I follow your work, so it is you are somebody who I feel like I know already, but you don't really know very much about me. We've talked a bit before.
It's like a first date then.
Yeah. Sure.
But I appreciate the the contact, like, you know, because you never, the thing about Twitter is you never really know who's reading your stuff.
Right.
You never know who likes it, who doesn't like it, who loves it, who hates it. You don't really have any idea. So when you hear from somebody that actually takes something from your work and there's a benefit from it, it's always very flattering. So
yeah. I really like your work. I mean, I don't get football, and we'll get to that later.
We'll see
where it goes. Yeah, it would be a waste to just get you to explain football to me, since I've asked other people and I should have learned by now. But like, the relationship that we have to people who we read, it's a strange thing. Like, I read your work and I like it, but I have this really vivid memory of reading a blog that you wrote on my iPhone, and it was a blog that you'd written about feminism, and it's really important to me as a man who also feels kind of who is a feminist, right? Yeah. And also feels cautious and worried about being a feminist.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are men out there, there are a few men out there who wear that like badge with in a way that I can like respond to, I guess, role models, people out there that I can like reach out to. But I was reading that blog feeling that, waiting to have a vasectomy, an elected vasectomy, because I don't want to have children, right? Yeah. Which is a feminist decision, I feel.
But also quite a profound decision, like on a personal, right, it's like in another way back. That's really profound, I think.
Yeah. No, yeah, it is a profound decision, but it's one of the reasons that I did it is because I believe in body autonomy, right? And I believe in a woman's right to choose, which means that if I want to make sure I don't have children, then I have to take control of my own body and stop expecting other people's bodies to do what I want.
Yeah.
And so it was great. And, you know, I don't know. It was a really like heightened moment as well. So you're right. Your words were really like penetrating me. And as someone who writes myself, it's interesting to think that, you know, there may be a time when somebody's reading, you know, something that I wrote in a weird heightened state.
Well, you never know. You never know what I think connects with people. That's the thing. You put this work out there. It's so strange. Especially in the immediate world of social media, it's almost like It's like allowing a boat to sort of set sail. You're there at the dock with your argument or your debate or your opinion piece, whatever it might be that you chose to publish in a blog, and you just push it out there, and you hope the sea takes it wherever it takes it. And you have no idea where it's going to end up. Yeah. You have no idea where it's going to dock. This is the thing. You have no idea where it will connect.
Yeah.
And I think the thing about social media is you see that, and the fact that, you know, to be honest, I'm glad it brought some measure of comfort, because to take a choice like that, like a bodily vasectomy, that's probably quite a rare thing to do. And and the principle behind it, and, you know, talking about feminism, if we can get straight into it.
Yeah.
I'm really nervous at the moment. I couldn't call myself a feminist ally. Right. I don't have the strength to call myself that. I don't have the comfort to call myself that, because I've always felt, for me to be to say that, it would feel complacent coming from me. I understand guys that call themselves feminist right. allies. I respect them.
I don't even call myself a feminist ally. I actually call myself a feminist.
See, that's the thing. I think, yeah, so carry on.
But I understand the reluctance, right? Because for years I did not. And for years I didn't even, I said that I can't call myself a feminist. And then a number of feminists who are women, who happen to be women, and a few feminists who are men, but on this show generally told me that I should not feel like that can't be something I can own. It doesn't mean that I should be dominating the feminist spaces or the discourse, but
no, it's the opposite. I think I
have to speak to men about why they should be feminists. I should not be speaking to women about like their lives.
Well, here's
here's
the funny thing about it. It's very interesting in talking about rape culture to police feminist spaces, because that's where the conversation is happening. But actually, that's where the conversation is been done. Like, the theory's been done, and it's almost now for men to go and try and propagate that in different spaces where it's not getting. So I was talking to him the other day about this. We're going up to see a game of football up in Manchester, and what was interesting was I realised then that actually a lot of the time men don't talk to men about sexual violence against women.
Mm-hmm.
They don't really talk about it. Like, if we do talk about it, it's reactive. It's like, oh, that terrible thing that happened. I can't remember the last time I sat down with male friends of mine, we discussed rape culture as a thing, as an actual abstract topic. We didn't come up, because I think that it's portrayed as a women's issue to be talked about by women, to women, for women, and men only really get involved at the tail end of things to be like, oh, really? Like, wow, that terrible thing that happened. And also, men will discuss that with women, but they won't discuss it with other men.
Yeah.
And that's really interesting, that dynamic. I think that's something that men can do, that we can definitely do to make things, to improve things in terms of the situation. Because there's those conversations that just aren't being had at all.
Well, also, I think it's an interesting one. I think that gender and the patriarchy kind of element of it is an interesting one, because I think that the patriarchy does really hurt men too, right? It makes us into bodies to be fought in wars. Wars are fought generally by men. It makes us into actual things.
Well, look at rape. Like, look at rape in wartime. Look at rape generally. Right. The imposition.
Oh, it's terrible what men do during war. I absolutely agree, but it's terrible what's done to men as well.
This is the thing. Like, look, I mean, look even at the tool of rape as a weapon. That is the final. That's the end product. I mean, what a hateful.
Right.
This is as a reproductive tool. You're using that to like basically assert yourself over other men in some hierarchy, other women. You know, and that's the end point of men being brutalized to such a point that they are basically just like vessels of hatred. Like, there's the dehumanization of men through what patriarchal has done. The patriarchal structures is horrifying. Yeah. Actually, it's really
which
horrifying.
Means it is our issue. It is absolutely. For us to be getting on with, because we need to like talk to men and stuff. When I was growing up, I was bullied at school like severely by men. Like my stepdad hit me. Right, those are things that come through the patriarchy.
Absolutely,
right? And they affected me. Like, so I should be fighting the patriarchy.
And it's the unprocessed. All that unprocessed pain manifests itself in very ugly states. Like, you know, this unprocessed anger, the insecurity, all these things. And then these are then sort of, they then mutate into a sense of entitlement towards women, or those who are physically weaker, be they women or other men, shorter men, you know, men who are less, you know, that's where the stereotype of campness comes from with gay men. And the reason that stereotype is in relation to effeminate men, the reason why that stereotype about, you know, gay men being effeminate and whatever, even though plenty of heterosexual men have effeminacy or whatever.
I was bullied at school. One of the ways I was bullied was homophobic bullying, but I'm straight, right?
Yeah.
And that's another thing. Like, straight men should be absolutely, and women, straight people should be fighting for gay rights, because of the fact that it hurts us too, these homophobic ideas. I was straight and I was hurt, you know? Yeah.
Well, this is crazy. And the crazy thing about it is, that so much the reason
you should be doing it because you're decent anyway. I'm not saying you should only be doing it for self-interested reasons, but I can't believe that people don't like do it for self-interested reasons. Like, people hate themselves
so much. This is the thing. This is the reason why these stereotypes are so enduring, is that people are so invested in it. Like, people, it's difficult for people to define themselves as strong of themselves a lot of the time. You know, it's hard to look in the mirror and be like, I am strong regardless of what people think of me.
Yeah.
As to how they do that, you assert yourself against others. Which is why these stereotypes persist. It's why on TV we still have, like, women portrayed a certain way, we have men portrayed a certain way. We have, for example, is the lack of, let's say, for example, the lack of Asian men in right. leading roles in Hollywood, the lack of Asian men as figures of desire,
right,
or auxiliary. Like, you know, I think one of the few films actually that has an Asian character who has autonomy, who gets the hottest girl in the film, is actually The Fast and the Furious.
Okay.
Where the cool guy that works right. in tech gets the, is it Gal Gadot, the...
But he still works in tech. But there's still, there's still the racial stereotypes within that, right?
Absolutely, but he's still... That's the one film I look at, I'd be like, wow, of all the guys in the film who are after the hottest girl in the film, he gets her, which is a terrible... It's still like a... It's got its own issues,
yeah.
but it's the fact that they gave him that sort of form of, like, you right. know, sexual romantic yeah. primacy. That, to me, is actually, in a small way, quite groundbreaking.
Right.
Like, in a blockbuster film to have that. In the same way that you've got Spock. You know, Spock, basically, Zachary Quinto, openly gay actor playing Spock, but who can actually go toe-to-toe with Chris Pike, you know, Kirk, and actually, like, beat him in a fist fight.
Yeah.
But is the smartest and gets the hot girl who is a black girl. It's like, it's interesting how Star Trek actually, for its flaws, and that second film has got, you know...
I haven't seen it yet.
It has its issues, don't get me wrong, it definitely has its issues, and... There's a lot of people of a feminist, you know, feminist perspective will have a big issue with that film.
There's a scene that is completely gratuitous.
There's a woman that drops her like, drops her dress and has got underwear on, and Kirk is basically leering over.
And there's no real justification for that.
It's just a terrible scene, and even J.J. Abrams even said there's no place for that. But it's a funny film because at the same time you have got a character like Spock who kind of is boundary breaking. Who subverts the?
Although
kind
he's still
of
straight, he's still gay playing straight though. It's not. They didn't make him like gay though, did they? I mean, that would have been good. Spock and Kirk having a gay relationship.
That's an alternative universe entirely. But who knows? Who knows what the next Avengers may bring? We never know.
Yeah, right. That's true. So the second question that I ask people is, "What do you do now?" So people might have already sort of got an idea of what you do now. But what would you say to that question?
Right now I write poetry and I perform poetry around town, which is what I left. I used to be a lawyer before. I was a solicitor way back when, but I'm much more happy now. And that's back in 2005 that I left the law. So I'm a poet now. I'm also a I suppose journalist, and I write for different publications, so the New Statesman a bit, some stuff for the Independent, some stuff for the Guardian, and sometimes for This Is Africa, which is the African publication of the Financial Times. And so I write for them about tech, sponsorship, all that random stuff. I also make a bit of music, so I do electronica with a friend of mine. I sing sometimes, it's just spoken word of it. Yeah. And I'm a football writer, so I cover Manchester United for ESPN. I do a bit of broadcasting too. And a bit also, I do a bit of PR consulting because I worked in PR for several years, so I also advise clients on their public relations. So yeah, it's a bit of a mix.
Yeah, I mean, you're like doing some of the things that I hope to be doing when I go freelance in terms of like having a wide portfolio of stuff and doing, because I'm quite like that. I think I saw when I was looking on your website today, sort of like in prep of this, there was a quote on there like calling you a Renaissance man, and I would feel weird saying that about myself, but I aspire to that, like, or a Renaissance person, someone who does lots of
I think you're right, because it's not something you call yourself, like if you can get, I mean, that obviously someone who I really respect and who wrote
yeah it was thought, a good quote to put on your website.
I thought it's a great quote, but it's something you can never call yourself, because frankly, like, it means that you've said, you come to a point where you're not just someone who does these things for hobbies. You're like really top of your game,
right?
Let's be honest. Like, in the last few centuries, we've only seen a handful of people that could call themselves Renaissance men or Renaissance women. Like, there's very few people can actually call themselves that, and you have to have mastered every art. And even if you had, you still couldn't call yourself that. But
yeah,
it's a nice
thing to aspire to, though.
Yeah, no, of course. It's really nice to aspire to excellence in all these fields, because actually, the people who've achieved excellence in all these fields end up having perspectives on life that are so broad that, you know, you just have a perspective that's unparalleled. And I aspire to that for sure. Absolutely, I aspire to that.
Yeah, and well, that's the thing, I think, from having talked to you off mic beforehand, and like immediately when I met you off the tube, you were very like talking, and I'm like that, right? So I like that, I dig that, but we very very quickly got into a conversation, and I think that's sort of reflective of probably the kind of minds that can't just do one thing, that have to end up doing loads of things, because you just flitter about and looking for connections between the different things, right?
Yeah,
and that's what I do. Yeah.
One thing we're taught in, well, one thing we're not taught, I think, in education is to take a unified view of things.
Yeah.
One of the most exciting moments I had when I was doing my law degree at uni, which I actually really enjoyed by the end. I didn't enjoy the first sort of year and a half of it. But when I was doing my revision for my finals, I suddenly came to see law, the study of law, as just, it was like studying the anatomy of society. You know, because when you study law, you study contract law or tort law or jurisprudence or administrative law, public law, you study trusts, and then you, all these things in the different sections, like criminal law, whatever. And then you step back and you look at the organic development of the law and you realise it all basically roots at the same tree. And you start seeing contract law cases pop up in tort and tort cases pop up in trusts and different and you start to realize, actually, wow, these are just different nodes of the same body. And if I step back from it, I've got this unified perspective that's really exciting. Mm. And what else can I do that with? I look at all the things I do. I might have listed a bunch of things that I do, but actually, they're all communication.
Right.
They're all the same. They're all unified. Yeah. So, you know, this morning, I wrote an article for my blog. This afternoon, I did a podcast about poetry. Then I met a friend of mine. I discussed some public relations with her.
Right.
And today, we're talking this evening. We're discussing politics and current affairs, but they're all the same. I don't feel any difference in terms of the intensity or the seriousness with which I discuss these issues.
It's interesting. Because, I mean, looking, because I'm going freelance and I've got to have a wide portfolio, I've got all these different things and I'm going to have a portfolio. I've been trying to find a unifying thing to describe them all, and I sort of came up with storyteller, because whatever it is, whether it's, and it's a similar kind of feeling, it's like, that's what I do, I tell stories. It might be cultural commentary, it might be stories, it might actually be like fiction, it might be a conversation, but they're all a kind of story, the journey, I guess.
That's a really important exercise you're going through there. I think going freelance is really exciting. It's can be terrifying, it's also empowering. And the reason I say empowering is, you know, you sit down there, you know, I don't know if you've got your website all up and running and over, but I sat there and I had to basically do a website from scratch. So I went up to WordPress.org, I think it was, and sat down with a bunch of these themes and ordered a couple of pizzas and got some coffee and sat down for a couple of days. And I was thinking, like, how do I sort of brand myself? You know, sound like a cow. You know, not a cow to brand myself, but... And I thought, well, what is it that I do?
Yeah.
And again, it's that thing, like, you communicate. And it's really quite strange having to sort of sit back and look at yourself from the detached perspective and sum up what it is you do. And it's very clear that we do both tell stories. Like, it's about narrative, isn't it? And some might say it's cynical, you're trying to command a narrative. It's actually about painting the broadest possible picture of what's going on. There are so many stories actually that go untold that are vital to the way our society develops. For example, there's a story not being told at the moment about the disenfranchised, you know, sort of white working class, you know, which manifests itself in the Chavs narrative.
Right.
Then the EDL now, Tommy Robinson. And I've got my concerns about how the EDL are being, you know, not that it's the EDL particularly, but how the struggles faced by people who are disenfranchised, white working class, are being portrayed, because you can play into the hands of reactionary forces. And so we need to be very sensitive about how we tell stories. We need to be sensitive about cultural narratives. Because I was talking the other day to a friend about this, about multiculturalism. People saying multiculturalism failed. And I was like, no, it hasn't even started.
It doesn't exist.
It hasn't even started. Right. Yeah. Well, integration hasn't even begun.
Right. Like,
at like centuries of, like, you know, of migration, centuries of imperialism, you know, we haven't had
we're a long way away for the reason way. That like me and you we're sitting in a room, we're having a conversation with different colors,
right.
But we're both people who can say, oh, like, describe what it's like to go freelance, right? That's a privileged position that we're both in,
right.
And so the true integration isn't there, because we can have that conversation, but not I couldn't, you know, that we are both privileged individuals. Like, looking I'm not doing this to like attack you, but looking back in your past, and I know it's going to be much more complicated than this, right? Because of race, for a start, right? Mm. But looking back in your past, you know, you went to Eton and you went to Oxford.
Absolutely.
And like, so in those terms, like, I didn't go to those institutions, but I went to university.
The privilege those places give me, and there I go talking over you. The privilege those places give me, the education, the quality of education is such that you have the ability then, I have the ability then, to go to a wider variety of countries and be able to set up shop.
Right.
Because those phrases, those places, they're a currency. Like, to have been to these places is a degree in itself. You know, go to a place like Eton, like, it has a currency, whether that's right or not, have respect on a wider basis. A law degree from Oxford, it does get you respect. It's a hard thing to achieve and to do, but it gets you a certain currency. And being freelance, I mean, look, here's the thing. I can operate independently, you know, I'm not loaded, don't get me wrong, I'm by no means loaded, but I have a financial freedom and a freedom of mobility that most people don't have. And when I write my articles, I try to respect people who are in those places, who don't have those freedoms to move around. I'm not going to be advocating...
It's not about being loaded, right? Because I'm not loaded either. It's about having the freedom to be poor. Do you know what I mean? In a weird way. Like, that some people choose to have less money and other people have no choice.
I think
and that's the thing. Like, when you get to a point where you're going, oh, I'll try being freelanced, you know, normally that means that you've got some fallback if it doesn't happen, if it doesn't work out.
Well, I did a law degree. You're absolutely preaching to the choir. I did a law degree at university. I became a lawyer. I trained as a lawyer because I knew that being a writer would not be something that sustained me in the short to medium term. Right. I knew that I would only really make it as a writer, you know, my late 30s to early 40s. I'm just getting started in terms of my career. And I knew this.
It's foresighted.
Which is why I did. I mean, when I was 16 years old, I could have done an English A-level, done an English degree at university. And I was like, no, I need to have that fallback. I need to have that corporate credibility.
Right.
Because that allows me to earn money. It allows me to earn money for consulting, which allows me more time to do the poetry,
to
do the creative writing. Because one thing I could not stand, one thing I hate, is the concept of being owned. I absolutely despise that. You know, I put comment on my blog, and people can like it or they can dislike it, but ultimately it comes from me and it doesn't come from some a line imposed from above, which is what I can't stand. And I think as an artist, the more freedom you can get, the more freedom you can carve out for yourself as an artist, the better. Because here's the thing, we all are compromised by either we censor ourselves or we are in countries where we can't speak our minds. I feel like I'm in a place, it's an oasis of relative calm and freedom. I think firstly because I'm not really on people's radar to that extent, that my views are regarded as troublesome enough or resonant enough for me to be a trouble to most people. I'm kind of in a privileged position where I can kind of say what I think, and if some people like it, then they like it, and others dislike it. But either way, they can disregard it, take it or leave it. That's a privileged position itself because I don't have visibility. But also, I'm in a position where I can say what I think.
Yeah.
That's an incredible liberty.
So, yeah. And you can say the things that aren't being said. Like, that's the thing. That one of the reasons that it's, you know, that's what we're talking about, like not having full integration. Mm. That's the thing. We're only hearing stories from the same kind of people.
Here's the thing as well about and one thing I will say now, I am in a privileged position. At the same time, I fought to get free of those structures. And I think, you know, this is the thing. I think we also have to remember, like, there is a cost to taking these leaps. And then that I'm 34 and I've made choices that give me this freedom, but they've come at a cost. They come at financial cost. They come maybe as a social cost. You know, I don't have children. You know, I don't have the dependence. And these things liberate me to say other things.
Right.
I'm sure in a different... And I don't want to judge people. I don't want to judge people for not saying what has to be said.
In fact,
that puts more responsibility on me in a way, in a privileged position to say stuff. I got someone, they sent me a tweet a few months ago. I don't want to sound narcissistic about this, but someone sent me a tweet, she goes, I like your work because you say stuff that actually I'm sometimes nervous to say.
Right.
And that's the thing, because not everyone, look, I get some abuse online or whatever, or different places, but I've probably got a thicker skin than I thought I did. I'm not that thick-skinned, but I've got a thicker skin than I thought I did. But for some people, it's actually still quite overwhelming. They feel like they're putting stuff out there.
It is.
And her point was basically, look, I like what you write. She's not saying she liked all of it, but she likes what I write, generally speaking. And she would like me to do more of it because actually she just finds it she's a bit more nervous putting stuff out there than I am.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, you know, that's fair enough, really.
Right. No, that's... Yeah, that is... It's important to have people saying things that are different from what we're hearing, that are challenging, but at the same time, I think people would also, we'd all be much safer saying those things if we were able to say them more, if there was more diversity, if we were more integrated, all of those kind of things.
Absolutely right.
And finding ways to make those things happen. Like, I think people in your position, and, you know, like some of the other, there's, you know, people who, like, I think Owen Jones is in a similar sort of position of, like, you're then interrogated, like, because or Laurie Penny, you've had sort of privileged backgrounds in some ways on some people's measures. I mean, I'm not saying all the way
no,
back.
But
people, like, treat you like you should be, like, magic on one side. And then on the other side, people are, like, I don't know, they're not as, you know, we need more people, I guess, like... Well, that's all the way across the board. It's not on your shoulders. You don't stand for All Black men, right?
Absolutely not. I think actually, and Owen and Laurie, they're different cases altogether because they are in a completely different stratosphere in terms of their visibility, their resonance, what they say, what gets out there. Like, you know, they really are in a different category.
For now, and whatever happens, you'll have to deal with. But they're still the same thing at different levels.
You're right. And in terms of the privilege, and those questions are absolutely fair.
Because, I get scared at my level. I get scared, like, sending a tweet. You know, like, I'll be like, is this going to get people, like masses of abuse, and that's like,
and you never know. Yeah, like, you never know what will come back. You put stuff out that, like, there's times I put stuff out that I'm like, you take a deep breath and you press publish. And I think, you know, getting interrogated about privilege and stuff, you know, I think it's fair, because I do get annoyed when people go, oh yeah, so, you know, they came from this background, now they've gone to Oxford. It's like, bloody hell, like, there's other universities out there, like there's Warwick and there's Leeds and there's, like, you know, Edinburgh.
Well, I don't think I'm particularly less privileged than the people who went to Oxford,
Exeter, there's these superb universities with great courses, and, like, why don't we broaden the discourse? Like, you know, and public schools as well. Like, you know, the one reason I do get defensive if people tar me with the same brush. Here's the thing I find offensive. People tar me with the same brush as, let's say, unnamed old Etonian politicians who are making political choices that I find reprehensible.
Right.
I get angry at that because I'm like, these aren't my views.
Right.
And the reason I have to, like, put my foot down with those situations is, if I go and I advocate a particular politics and you're still hung up on the fact that I hold those views just because I went to a certain place, then that will make my viewpoint less effective. And if I'm trying to advocate something which has merit in it, but please...
Yeah, why are you getting in the way of
that? Please, I mean, don't get me wrong, if you talk about the structural inequality of which Eton, you know, is in many ways a symptom, then absolutely I'm happy to go then. I've been there in my... But please, like, look at the merits of what I'm arguing. Because I say this because I was on... I was on Facebook a few months ago. I wrote an article about Nelson Mandela and his legacy and a contested legacy and the revision we were seeing shortly after his death. And someone tagged me on a post, which I wish I hadn't done. They tagged me on a post, this article by so-and-so. And people who are not friends of yours on Facebook now can comment on these threads.
Yeah.
And this guy was basically, like, having a bit of a personal dig at me. And he was doing it on sort of first name terms. So it was very strange. Someone you've never spoken to, which is, this is social media now, talking about you as if they know you. So Moose says this, Moose says that. And I'm like, that's so strange. Like, there's a sort of a false intimacy there.
Right.
And he was having a go at me, like, public school this, public school that. And I just thought, bloody hell, this is extremely passive aggressive, because he knows that I'm seeing this. And I just thought, I didn't actually engage in that situation, so I thought, look, the article speaks for itself.
Yeah.
But it made me wary of that kind of tripwire of, you know, that I don't have the kind of visibility now of these people.
Well, also it's not a very sound argument either, because to say that you went to Eton or that you went to Oxford is to say that things are equal. Like to tar you with the same brush, like, right?
I think that's not
exactly fair, is it? Because I doubt your experience of those institutions was the same as other
people.
No,
it wasn't. But in their defence, in the defence of people who do attack me for that, in their defence,
okay,
they are going against a structural,
massive
inequality. Yeah, right. In criticising Ethan Oxford, they're criticising a structural inequality. In respect of which, I suppose I'm an aberration. My presence, you know, there weren't many black people at Eton. There weren't many black people at St John's College, Oxford. There weren't many black people at Oxford. When I was there, I think there were, like, the year before I arrived at Oxford, there were fewer than 100 black students, like, university-wide out of 15,000. So there really weren't, you know. If people attack Eton and Oxford as places of inequality, I can't get too outraged by that attack on those places.
Right. I suppose, it's a little bit like saying, what about the men?
Exactly.
Okay.
My issue is when it becomes personal, then I have an issue, because I'm like, you can't take a pop at me because you don't know me. If you make a personal attack, you'll probably get a personal response. Because I've also got to show you that I'm not just a cipher.
Yeah.
I'm not what you might call an Uncle Tom. I'm not just, like, sort of. I'm not. But at the same time, what I do understand is the matrix. Here's the thing that's really important I should mention. The matrix of the establishment is such that if you go to school with someone from the age of 11 years old, and I'm now 34, 35 years old, and you've seen this person grow up at arm's length, they're, you know, 25 years later, and they're now in a position of authority in a city job, whatever, and you still see them now and again, like once every few months, you are far less likely to give them the kind of grilling, the kind of objective grilling right. they should receive
yeah.
from a complete stranger. That's the pernicious nature of the establishment.
And it's also
that's the problem.
Does it,
that's
and
the problem.
I would imagine it also works the other way as well. I mean, I think if you are employed by an organisation and you sort of meet the people in that in that organisation, if it's like, for example, the New Statesman or any media outlet, you know those people, they're your friends, and that's a good thing. And it's great to know people. And it's great to connect.
But here's the danger. Here's the danger of being exactly. You put your finger on it. Absolutely, you've absolutely put your finger on it. The fear I have of my work getting like broader reach and visibility is that you don't want to be co-opted in a situation where it's not a conscious thing, but where you can't speak your mind because you're offending people who you know. That's the fear. That's the right. fear that is always there. Like if someone you know or you work with a colleague says something egregious in public, and like luckily I've not been in that position. I felt like really that conflict too much yet. Can you keep speaking that truth when you've been co-opted and you're part of it? That's a very difficult thing, because then ultimately what's the important thing is the structural inequalities, be they racial, be they gender, you know, related, whatever. And yeah. That is your primary responsibility. And that's the difficult terrain that people that have media platforms will find themselves negotiating. It may not sound difficult to the average person, because the average person doesn't have to negotiate those things. And it's not difficult in the grand scheme of things, but it's like, it's calling, it's kind of like calling people on stuff. And it's difficult. I mean, like, I've been in situations only recently. These are commentariat problems, I suppose they'll be called.
Hashtag commentariat problems.
They're not real problems, but it's like...
But they're yeah. personal problems. Yeah, they actually exist for you as a person, right?
I think the key is stick to your guns. And this is why in my pieces, I try not to attack individual people. I try to criticise symptoms of inequality as opposed to individual people, because firstly, it's like, it's better manners. And secondly, actually, it's more effective because you don't get caught up in individual power plays.
But the argument always about manners, and that's my natural perspective, is that it's decent to be polite to people, right?
But it's not in the position. Yeah, there's a place.
Right. There's a complication though, because of the fact that you know, legitimately oppressed groups,
politeness is a luxury.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, we're angry. Stop telling us to be polite.
But I would never.
I'm just representing. I wouldn't either tell someone to.
And
but
that's an excellent point you make there. And we need to get into that. The politics of respectability. Ivan Massa wrote an article about, gay rights, basically in the Evening Standard, and he was talking about how gay people need to look at themselves in the mirror because, you know, the kind of the drug use, the hedonism is not playing well when we're looking for equal marriage. Yeah. And I was like, this is such a false dichotomy. There are so many reasons why.
Yeah.
There's so many reasons other than being single and young in a metropolitan, area. Yeah. Why gay people use, there's so many
right.
other reasons.
Well, maybe because they're an oppressed group. There are so many. There's so many elements,
complex.
Right. That's simplifying it, but they should at least consider
so many,
that,
so many.
Right?
And to me, the politics of respectability, the politics of politeness, the reason why I like addressing people in a way that is ready, polite and mild-mannered is because, generally speaking, I'm ready, polite and mild-mannered. My own personality is quite, believe it or not, is relatively timid, actually. And I'm relatively gentle as a person, so I'm very, very slow to anger. That's just who I am. I'm very, very slow to anger. And actually, here's the thing. Sometimes, actually, anger is the only thing that gets things done. You know, yeah. frustration gets things done. You look at one of the most powerful protests of recent times, and the set piece of Rosa Parks, you know, obviously it was orchestrated, but Rosa Parks, what was that? That was the power of frustration. Frustration is a political tool. You know, you wouldn't have got far being mild-mannered in those days. People had to have that rhetoric. It was a variety of Stokely Carmichael.
Well, I didn't even learn, right, in school when Rosa Parks was covered briefly, right, at school. I didn't even, like, it. The way it was sort of was phrased, I sort of felt like it was like, oh, an individual, a member of the public, got fed up and quite rightly, like, asked for her place in the bus. I didn't even realise that she was a seasoned activist who had been working for fucking years on that stuff. Like, that, it's patronising to present her that way, but I didn't know, you know, until so long it took me to find that out, you know. I think, I only learned it at 31.
Absolutely.
You know,
well, this is the thing. And the reason why politeness, I mean, I think, you know, anger has its uses. Because sometimes, here's the danger of politeness as a political strategy. Here's the real danger of it. it legitimizes outrages a lot of the time by default. If someone, to explain, someone does something to you which is absolutely outrageous. So you go to a bus stop, you're about to get on a bus, and someone slaps you in the face.
Right.
And then the bus drives off. And you stand there and you're like, you turn to the queue, well, that was rude, wasn't it? And they're like, well, maybe they're just like so Stockholm syndrome like you, they're kind of like, oh, wow, how outrageous, but how dignified. But actually, the quiet dignity often perpetuates the prejudice. It often enables greater prejudice. Audre Lorde, the poet, said, your silence will not protect you.
Right.
And sometimes it actually takes, this is absolutely outrageous. This behaviour is a scandal, like someone slapped me in the face. It takes anger. You know, take the video of that, upload it to YouTube and be like, this is what they're doing to us. This is disgusting, because sometimes anger jars people out of their complacency. You know, I actually think as a people, we're not angry enough in Britain. We're really not angry enough.
I know what you mean.
You look at protests, and they raise the rail fare every single New Year. And people get a bit angry, but then they move on. You know, they're raising... A nurse earns 90% of the average salary of the UK. I'm not having a go at nurses, really.
No.
We should be angry on their behalf, because these people are knackered, a lot of them, right?
Right.
People are working their asses off. Like, we've got a health system which has got its flaws, but it's being privatised out the nose.
Yeah, right.
It's being reduced to nothing. Like, we're not angry enough as a people. And we are very polite. We've got a stiff upper lip. We're being absolutely, like, run over the country.
I don't even necessarily think it's just the British. Like, I think that generally speaking, the way that the power structures of the world work is that people we're taught not to be to be angry in the right direction, right? So it's okay. I mean, it's no, I don't think any government officially sanctions this, but they don't mind people being violent personally, particularly. In fact, that gets them out of the way of them being politically violent. Do you know what I mean? Like domestic violence is to turn a blind eye on a most cultural kind of
violence
norms,
against
right?
property.
Violence generally.
God help you,
right?
Violence against property. Here's the thing.
So yes, right, culture protests
being stifled in this country. I think the Iraq War was a really traumatic experience for a lot of protesters, because turning out, you know, too many people turning out, and they were ignored.
Yeah.
They got, as a friend of mine said, you know, they all got politely ignored. A performance poet, Kay Tempest, said that, you know, and they got politely ignored. And I think that was a really seismic moment for public protest. And also, you go to like protests now. I was walking past the protest at London Bridge a few weeks ago, and the level of anxiety around people who are protesting.
Oh, yeah.
Are we being watched? Are there undercovers here? And they've done such an effective job in infiltration. You know, the state has done such an effective job in infiltrating the ranks. You know, I talk to people who are protesters. They've got multiple SIM cards.
Yeah.
Because they're afraid of, like, who's going to be around
them.
Well,
and it's amazing how these narrative, how that can work within the media narrative, right? I was on the March 26th of March, the big TUC rally, right? Mm. I was on that. And then after that, the UK Uncut action that changed it went to Fortnum and Mason's, right? You know, that day, right, when that happened. And I nearly went to Fortnum and Mason's with my eighty-five-year-old dad. That would have been interesting to see what they would have done with a really old person in that context of arresting people like they did. But the way, you know, the majority of the things that happened that day were not destruction of property, right?
No.
And what was really used was like the Black Bloc or whatever, the few anarchists who smashed up some banks, right? Not people. They didn't hurt anybody. They just smashed some property of like Barclays banks or whatever. Now, I'm not necessarily saying it's annoying that happened, because the power structures used that to make everybody else's. But we shouldn't blame the Black Bloc for that. We should blame the media for choosing to focus on one tiny event rather than the massive thing.
The thing, that's, I think with these events, you cover everything. You cover the criminal damage to property, but you also cover the grievances that led to it. You cover everything.
Right.
Like, you know, when the UK riots happened, let's deconstruct these riots. Let's look at the consumerism. Let's look at the discontent. Let's look at all of it. Let's embrace all of it. So, for example, I went to a climate change rally. It was the House of Parliament a couple of years ago. 50,000 people were there, I think. And some people reported it as 30,000. I spoke to one friend of mine working for a right-wing publication that shall remain unnamed, And he was working on the arts desk there, and he said specifically they were told not to cover it. He said they were told, there was a discussion on the news floor, we're not covering the climate protest. This is a specific, this actually happened like 2 or 3 years ago. And I know this because I know the guy, I know the guy's name, I know the publication's name, everything. And he was on the arts desk. And that's mind-blowing.
Yeah, I mean, that was actually, so, it was so sad. Yeah, exactly. And that was, that's how I felt that day. I came back and I was so sad that this day that had been so, actually, so unifying, right, that everyone had really come together, you know, and, I'm sure you, you know, I was on the Iraq march as well and it was the same feeling, right? In the moment, on the march, there's so many of you. You think they have to listen. They have to listen. And then you come back and you look at the newspapers, and it says a different number of people were there than actually were there. And you can't prove anything.
No.
That's the official figures that are out, and you can't prove it.
All you can do is create alternative media platforms.
Yeah.
And competing narratives.
Which actually, I guess, is where we have a hope now, to a certain extent.
Absolutely, that's right. That's where there is hope. I mean, I've got concerns about a lot. I mean,
yeah, me too.
But don't get started on, like, you know, I'm nervous about where we're heading as a society, for a variety of reasons. One of them is that the reactionary media is so well represented. So, you know, whereas, you know, so the liberal publications, as they are, you know, they're in the minority and they are going under a lot. I mean, the Guardians have a terrible financial problems. The Independent's got a relatively liberal bent, you know, I suppose, and that's going under really financially. There is not so much money for really good, independent, progressive, investigative journalism.
Yeah.
That's a concern. These things are falling away. And what I worry about, not so much the rhetoric you see with politicians, is there's so little conversation about job creation. What's the new economy going to look like?
Yeah.
And it's like we're going around the houses, because I think that people, I think I was writing a blog today, that politicians lack either the imagination or the sensitivity to produce compassionate responses to these problems.
Yes.
Or long-term responses to these problems.
Yeah.
So even the jobs that have been created, these are, like, you know, unstable positions, like, you know, short contracts, temporary contracts. These aren't jobs. This isn't infrastructure.
Well, they have no connection. People in power. I mean, and this is something, like, I mean, we were sort of talking earlier on about how you know people who are within the 1%, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah. Sorry.
And well, that political, the political classes and the people with the money, who are kind of similarly overlap in lots of ways, that they don't have any actual experience of the everyday lives of the people who they're making decisions about. And if you meet them, sure, you'd have experience of their life,
well,
but they still wouldn't get.
I mean, you and I globally are probably in the economic 10%. We're probably in the 10%.
Maybe.
You and I. In terms of, like, our access to education, and maybe even the contents of our bank accounts.
Maybe.
You know, if you look at people that earn a dollar a day or whatever.
Right.
You know, in that sense.
I agree.
In our society as well. Like, within our society, I say, you know, my friends who are in the 1% in terms of their earnings, and a 1% being above, you know, people who earn over 150k or whatever.
Right.
Like,
because there's a 0.0111%. That's a real, you know, that's the thing. There's always a higher percent.
So here, those people. No, that's probably like 0.01% over 100k. These are friends of mine. I will say this: some of my closest friends from uni, they're now millionaires. They're living abroad. They're whatever. They're doing their thing. But these people are not, I think, crucially dictating policy. This is the concern I have when you're in that environment and you're drawing up policy, because my friends ultimately will be subject to whatever policies are passed, okay, in this country, and there'll be the taxes, whatever, and they'll...
Yeah, it's a cabinet that's all made up of people who went...
My concern is the people currently in charge, a lot of their feet didn't touch the ground.
No.
David Cameron, you know, he went to Eton, he grew up in Oxfordshire, you know, in Chipping Norton, he went to Oxford... He joined the Bullingdon Club, which is interesting because Oxford is an elite academic institution, but then to seek out further elitism within Oxford, to seek out the most elite form of club within Oxford, the most patriarchal, that tells its own story to me. You know? And people say, oh, it was Bullingdon, he was young. Actually, it wasn't that young. Like, you go to a place like Oxford, you're 18, like, you're not a kid anymore.
Right.
And to seek that out and to be in that club for 3 years, I think it does say quite a lot about you.
Well, and also, if you are young, then that kind of says even more, because if you go straight into that, you don't get... A lot of people, when they go to university, what they have is their horizons broadened,
and
right?
To seek actively to narrow your horizons is interesting. And then he goes to David Cameron goes to work for Carlton. a TV company. He works, he does PR there. I think he ends up as a think tank, and then he's like, you know, he runs for office. Now, here's the thing, like, the guy's our prime minister, and I can't see at any point that he learned to empathise with regular people. Don't get me wrong, he's had personal tragedy, like he lost a child.
Yeah,
like
he's
experienced that. He has experienced definite heartbreak. But one thing he hasn't experienced is living hand to mouth.
Right.
And actually, at a time like this, that couldn't be more valuable as an experience.
Yeah.
Like, not saying that he should have vibed, but to have people in your circle who just know what that's like. Like, you know, here's the thing. The beauty, I suppose, of freelancing, going for broke after leaving the city, was that when I left the city in 2005, my CV couldn't get me a job anywhere because I was overqualified. So I had to, like, I was temping. I couldn't get a job for 6 months because handing my CV at bars and pubs wasn't getting replies. And I ended up getting a job for $6.50 an hour, working at the Home Office in Croydon for a few months, for 8-9 months. So I was earning, like, what, £850, I think it was, a month, and paying rent. My rent was half that, and I was paying £10. I was spending £10 on food, but luckily I'm a good cook, so I was fine.
Yeah.
But I was broke as hell. And, like, it was good because I was absolutely broke. And actually, I carried on being broke for a few more years. I then left my old job in 2011 to go freelance. The first year that I remember, my first tax return I submitted as a freelancer was a few hundred quid. I was absolutely skint. So I've experienced tears of frustration trying to do something. You know,
I've got a horrible feeling that's on my horizon. But
no, yeah, but here's the thing. Here's the thing. No, not that not sound masochistic, but you know what? Like, I can say they've actually experienced it. You know, you go on a date with someone and you're so broke, you're not sure if the bank's going to spit your card out. You know, that's happened to me. You know, I've not even supported a family being broke. But I'm grateful for that experience.
That's it. I mean, I've been relatively broke at various times. And, like, I just realised as well, like, one of the things that... It may have sounded like I was more reluctant to say I was in the 10. I might be in the top 10%. I don't know the percentages.
But,
globally, exactly. That's what made me, like, go, oh, yeah, that sounds right. But I realise when people come into my house, and that's where we're recording this, it seems like I've got a greater degree of wealth because I rent from my sister, and like I've got like so.
We're currently in palatial residence. We're actually just at the bottom of the mountain.
Well, it's actually, it's a really, I mean,
on,
it
on
is.
The podcast, you can't see this, but it's an elegant 8-bedroom Georgian joking.
No, but you know, like, it's funny when people come into my house, I always give them the spiel, but we were so busy talking. But I shouldn't need to do that spiel. Says something about, like, I don't know. I mean, I'm happy to admit to my privilege, but I'm always scared of being seen as a little bit more privileged than I am. I think everybody's in that position, right?
There's a danger. I think there is a real danger of getting caught up in how privileged you are individually.
Right.
Because I think it detracts from...
The structural issues. Right.
Yeah, this is the real danger I have about it. Because actually, it's like, I mean, for example, James Arthur, for example, has been trending on Twitter for the last 2 days. Why? Because James Arthur, you know, pop star... has been very misogynistic, and so he's being attacked on it. And he's the top trending topic on Twitter, has been for the last 2 days. Now, at the end of the day, ultimately, James Arthur is not a threat.
Right.
He is not a threat. He does not propagate structural inequalities. He may be, at the very most, a symptom of them.
Right.
Because someone in his position with his views can still be successful, still have a career, having made those statements. And regardless of, like, you know, his unpopularity, he still has a pop career. You know, so, you know what I mean? He's ultimately, like... And also James Arthur, like, he worked his way out from wherever, so, like...
Right, everyone's got some context,
so much attention to James Arthur. And what's happened to the UK? The banks are bursting in the Thames. Like, it's flooding, chronic underinvestment. Like, if we had a sense of priorities, we'd be looking at the structural problems that we're going to face from climate change not being addressed, adaptation strategies. Those are things that really ultimately matter. And it's so easy to be diverted, I think, by personal issues, be they privilege or be they, like, you know... ignorant comments and prejudice or whatever, like, ultimately they're issues that are they're diversions, but they're not the real, you know, your sister owning a nice property, you rent a nice property from your sister, yes, it's a nice property, but
yeah,
what is that in the grand scheme of things? How is that actually affecting
diversity? I'm really aware that even, like, to try and prize it out is kind of like wringing your hands too much anyway. Like, sure, I don't have that much money myself personally, but clearly, if, like, it doesn't, like, the way it used to work is that your family, like, to a certain extent, like, I will always be bailed out by my family if I screw up, because, like, there's not that much money. I mean, you're not even talking big amounts of money, that's the thing, but you don't need much money to be able to be safe for the rest of your life.
Here's another question.
You don't need much, you know, it's terrible.
Here's another question. why isn't this property readily affordable to so many people?
Right, that's really true. Right.
Why can't you buy this property? Why do you have to rent it? Why is it not? Here's the thing. What happened to the cost of property in the last 20, 30 years? So explosively, the property went from being something that could be a reasonable expectation to a financial asset.
Yeah.
You know, there's an article in the Evening Standard about the cost of living in the UK and how, like, you know, property was now like, it was a form of business. They monetized it. Everything is being monetized. That's the question that I have. You know, you look at the cost of living, people's, I think I mentioned this article that I wrote today about the fact that people's wages are not keeping pace with inflation.
Right.
Or the cost of property. The price of London rent, when I came to the UK, when I came to work in London and work in the city, I paid a rent of £575 and I was living in the Docklands a month. And I'm proud to say it was a fairly low rent. Most of my peers were paying 800. The average rent now is, what, 15 in London? The average, it's insane. Rent rose by 10%. The average rent rose by 10% in 1 month last
year. Yeah, well, I'm out of the loop because I've got this ridiculously great deal. But when I came to London myself, I went from having, like, we could have, in Lancaster, we could rent a house, right? Two bedrooms. It was a modest, small house, but it was a house. And when we came to London for the same price, it had to be, you know, like the smallest.
A box room, yeah. And this is nuts. The cost of living has just exploded. And this was not inevitable. It didn't have to be this way. This is the direct result of neoliberal economic policy.
Right.
Just run wild. That's the thing. Now, you could have got caught up in a conversation about this is a nice house, but actually, the more pressing question is actually, why have we come to this?
Right.
Why don't people have the expectation of living in places like this? You know, it's a nice, for those listening to the podcast, I can assure you, it's just, you know, it's a perfectly nice suburban house.
Yeah, but like for a lot of people listening to it, you're not going to think it's that impressive a place. Like it'll just be like the house you grew up in. It's just like I'm
there's a Sony
hyper aware
VHS
of privilege
in front of me. There's a Sony VHS
But I think that's the thing. Like it when you're sort of like approaching these things as we were talking earlier on about, like, through empathy, like that being the, like, a thing that's an important way of, like, reaching out and sort of like connecting the dots. Like the problem is that the people in power don't have empathy with the people who, like, they haven't had the experience. They don't have any kind of way of reaching it and understanding
that. This is the tragic thing about it. And I don't know if I made this point clear, but I think the emotional connection, I don't think these people are personally unpleasant. I think some of them are. I think some of them are just ignorant. Ignorance is also a loaded word. I think some of them are also unaware.
Yeah.
I read this. I read a comment by Ian Duncan Smith talking about helping disabled people back into work. And there was an expression he used that was really interesting. He said he was talking about disabled people festering, his fear that disabled people would fester on benefits. And I was like, festering, what a Victorian vision. It's almost like so people with bed sores and whatever. And I said, did it occur to you that there are actually people who are incapable of working because of disability, for whom daily life is a struggle,
Who are chronically dying as a result of this,
fatigued, who are just the ones with ME, people with ME supporting two or three kids and a husband who might have been out of work. Like, these are people that I know, and it's like the word fester is so revealing.
Yeah, I don't understand why they don't know those people though, because I know those people. Doesn't disability know no class, you'd think. But they don't seem to have any idea.
Tim Montgomery wrote was commenting. There was someone. Let me get this right. The Twitter account for the class think tank, called Class, tweeted a comment from Tim Montgomery, a quote from him, saying that ministers privately admit that the reason they're going soft on cuts of pensioners is because pensioners are more likely to vote. And that to me was such a supreme act of cynicism. Let's cut them because they're... That is so cynical. That is so profoundly cynical. That upsets me. Some might say, well, you're a bleeding heart liberal. That's how politics is. At what point did politics become a process whose only purpose was to serve itself?
Right.
At what point did the hammer start hitting things because it was a hammer as opposed to put nails down in place?
The
thing. It was almost like, you know, capitalism and politics, these processes, we created them, I hope, to enable the betterment of society as a whole, and they then became things that we worship as gods.
Right,
this is so true. These abstract concepts became gods. We've elevated them. We elevated you know,
well, they run themselves now, right? The program runs itself.
Exactly.
Right?
Which is the irony, you know, look at algorithms, you know, we're now run by forces above us. You know, this is the irony as well.
Yeah. I mean, what do we do? Like, what do you think we do? I mean, like, you're about that. Like, how, I mean, this is something I've been thinking about a lot now. I'm sure, like,
can I be very,
people
let,
are.
Let's get the naive part of the podcast, because people can listen to me like, oh, that's so naive. But I think actually it's better to risk sounding naive and recommend things that actually might sound radical or ridiculous in order that in people's reaction to me, something goes, oh, that's naive, but maybe elements of it might work. How about some aspect of debt cancellation? How about some form of mutual debt cancellation, like agreed debt cancellation? Because actually, if debt is making people miserable to such an extent and it's creating inequalities, why don't we just cancel some of it? Like, I'm not sure what percentage you would do, but let's just
I
say,
agree
look,
with this.
These people are over, you know, they're overspent, whatever. Okay, all a bit crazy. Let's just have a bit of a debt amnesty, a bit of a write-off. Why not have some aspect, some partial debt write-off? I don't know. Maybe that's part of it, because it just seems to me that's one thing that we can actually do.
There's an episode of This American Life. I can't remember what country it's talking about, but it's all dedicated to money. And there is a country that basically just went, oh, it's all too much. Let's just recreate make a new currency, get rid of our current currency, make a new currency, start again. And it basically worked.
I just think that's just one idea. I think, you know, here's one other thing I would do. Because I think it's easy to like look at what's wrong, but how do you fix it?
Right.
I say, well, Musa, what are your solutions? Like, okay, well, fair question. What else would I do? I would ring fence a percentage of corporation tax that was collected every year, and I would devote that to an institution of independent financial regulation. I know that sounds boring, but my point is this. If you look at the game of rugby, for example, right?
Right.
There was a point in rugby where eye gouging and all this off-the-ball activity was not being stamped out. What happened in rugby? They introduced instant replays. They introduced sin bins. They introduced mics. You could hear what the players were saying to
referees
and what the decision was. They introduced a transparency, right? And if you look at rugby now, there are still decisions that go on that don't get picked up. But there is a clarity, and there's penalties. There are things that cost you. Imagine if there were like temporary suspensions for traders, so you couldn't trade for. Let's say that you got caught for some egregious trading, whatever. You couldn't trade for a certain period of time, or you had like a temporary custodial sentence or whatever. There were like sort of sin bins for people who had particularly egregious patterns of trading that were, you know, that were criminal in nature. Imagine if you had these penalties, like the social censure. People, look, people are proud. People like, can you imagine we have these things like sort of financial sin bins, where if your trading patterns are a certain amount for a certain point, you can't trade for 6 months. You can't trade for whatever.
I certainly prefer this idea to giving them a bonus, despite the fact that they have already.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like these things are
right.
And the reason why I mentioned rugby is because I see capitalism as a contact sport. Trading these things, like the free market, is a brutal place. People escape with bloody noses, right? But what I saw with you know, the credit crunch, the symptoms they go up to, you know, financial doping, whatever. You just saw a lot of, almost like, it was like watching a game of rugby, and there's all this eye gouging and like, you know, punching off the ball and trampling on hands at the bottom of the ruck. And the referees were just going, oh, we're not going to
crack
down
about
it. And to me, like, let's increase the penal structures around it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one step I take to it. And the reason why I would, you know, the way that like teachers got completely, your teachers for years had a terrible public image. Those who can do, those who can't teach.
Right.
Wherever that came from, I don't know. And they've taken steps to address that. I don't think actually teaching is looked upon so badly now, primarily because it's ironically one of the more stable professions now.
No, that's true.
That's partly it. In the same way that the perception of teaching has changed, the perception of financial regulators can change.
Yeah.
These are people who are actually guardians of the economy. And a lot of financial regulators are afraid of going too hard, I think, on banks, because ultimately they might end up with jobs in these banks. Now, if we had a situation where you could be a financial regulator for life, you could go to university and study financial regulation as a thing that was respected. Because that's the thing, if you pay a financial regulator really, really well, and that person is impartial, they can be trusted to go into a company and regulate it and break up if needs be, if it's too egregious.
Right.
And that person is respected as a pillar of the community, and they can have, you know, a good pension up until old age or whatever, and they never have to fear changing career or fear going in and cracking down on a bank or company whose conduct is particularly reprehensible or abhorrent or egregious or whatever, then I think we've got the beginning of something. And I know it sounds unsexy, but I think financial regulation is a really big part of this.
Well, I don't think it necessarily sounds unsexy. I mean, if anything that could, anything that could improve the situation as it stands in any way is should be being thought about.
Well, there was also, here's the thing as well, let me throw this into the mix as well. There was a government department that was for every pound that was spent on it was bringing in, I think, 70 odd pounds in taxes, in tax revenue. And this wasn't, here's the thing, this wasn't about taxing the rich more, because I'm not sure that's necessarily even the right thing. There's a lot of tax that's already due. There's a lot of tax that's right. already due. You know, this is not about asking for more money. If we just collected the tax that was already yeah. due, that money could be drawn down to, let's say, pay for more flood defences. Or, and you know, I do with that collected tax, I do with it, I'd invest in R&D. Like, one thing that we really have an opportunity in Britain is we've been exporting engineering techniques for years. We've got development teams in Africa right now as a country. We should be looking beyond our borders and thinking, what construction capabilities can we offer as consultants to different places? What jobs can we create? Let's be opportunistic about this and actually think of a strategy, a long-term strategy. And the reason R&D, people don't want to spend money on it. It's not a vote winner. But here's the thing. It's not just about winning votes. It's having politicians who are brave enough to make the choices that will affect the country positively 10, 15 years from now. It's being brave enough to go into office and make big choices that would. And this is the thing. Some actually say that the Tories, actually ideologically driven, are trying to do that. Some might say it's a power grab, and I see the argument for that. But some might also say we're brave enough to do what we have to do to get ourselves. Well, we might be voted out. We've done the things that need to be done. Now, I think that from a progressive point of view, that has to be done as well. I think people have to go into office thinking, I might not survive this term.
Right.
But I've got to put things in place. And I would definitely, to the point about the R&D, I would invest in scientific research. There was an article written in the mid-90s, I think it was. It was actually a letter to the Times. And it was written to address to Tony Blair. And it was co-signed by, I think, 50 members or dozens of members of the Royal Society saying, this government is not investing in research. We're falling behind the rest of the world. And they were right. You know, so I think, you know, investment in a country's future is really, really important. And that, when I say that, I don't articulate a cutting of this thing. I actually think we should be spending now to reap benefits.
So that addresses some of the issues that addresses the
job creation. Yeah, a bit of the future. Absolutely.
It addresses some of the environmental issues, possibly.
Globalisation as well, because in a global economy, we have to have skills that are transferable. Not everyone is going to be able to set up shop here. Or if they set up shop here, they may have businesses abroad. You know, I'd invest actually in languages as well. I'd definitely invest in languages and capability with the outside world. Because English isn't always going to be the dominant business language. I think we've had a very good run of things. See, look at English. Is the governing law for so many contracts. It's also the governing business language. You look at Mandarin now.
Right,
Mandarin. You look at
Spanish. Yeah, right.
You look at Portuguese to an extent with BRIC countries. You know, you look at Arabic as well. Like, we've got to be global citizens. We've got to look beyond our borders. Otherwise, we'll just get swallowed up by this.
No, sure. But how do you? What about the? I mean, if you're going to come up with solutions, what about the broader, like, structural and inequalities and systems of various different systems of oppression, I guess. I mean, that's one of the ways that we frame it these days in the left. Like, how what do you do about them?
Oh my goodness, I mean, like, you know,
I'm not suggesting you've got the answer, well, but no, since no, you're no, coming no, up with some others,
well, no, you look at rape culture and where that comes from, and you look at the diversity of female, you know, the range of female voices in the media. You know, where does that start? That starts with informal conversations with editors of newspapers about these issues, and not in some kind of, like, you know, quote unquote diversity workshop, because that I find offensive. It's really about what is the variety of voices, and having a real honest audit about why are there so few female voices? Why do particular publications get attacked for not having more women writing for them when actually other publications get a free pass? You know, really having a hard look at ourselves as a society, how it manifests itself in policy. I think we should be teaching more women on the curriculum.
Yeah,
we should be reading more female writers. Their discourses are absolutely vital. You know, Margaret Macmillan, who wrote The Uses and the Abuses of History, one of the best deconstructions of historical analysis I've read in absolutely years. Absolutely brilliant, really perceptive. And really, just the message of her work is always deconstruct.
Well, we amazing. Need to listen to more voices, right? Because history is one voice.
Absolutely.
And that's, like, the exciting thing. Like, you mentioned Audre Lorde earlier on, and, like, one of the things she says, if I won't remember the quote, but she says a thing about if she doesn't define herself for herself, you know, like
others will do it for
right.
her. Right. Absolutely.
And that's the thing. We're defining other people all the time. I mean, when I say we, I mean, yeah, people very much like me, unfortunately. But I don't want to be defining people. I want to be listening to people.
Well, absolutely. And we talk about, you know, what to
no,
do
for selfish reasons. That sounds like selfish reasons, I want to listen to people.
Well, here's the thing. You know, you talk about like policy changes. I think in schools, I think in curriculums, let's talk about these issues. You know, they say that we can't study issues like rape culture. Well, not being funny, we study the Tudors and the Stuarts. If we can study, if we can study the very epitome of rape culture, which is Henry VIII beheading two of his wives,
right?
And we can study that, and there's not a problem with that at all. Then we can sure as hell study rape culture and feminist theory in schools.
Well, there was those. Did you see recently those pictures of black people during the Tudor times who've been basically airbrushed out of history? That there were pictures of wealthy black men, and we've never. I don't remember studying them at school. We've already covered the fact that I wasn't taught Rosa Parks properly.
I wrote an article about this a few weeks ago. And Michael Gove was saying how we should teach, you know, the causes of World War One and all the rest of it, and the true causes. And I was like, wait, let's talk about empire, because a lot of, you know, World War One was fought to a large extent upon the resources that were grabbed from these countries just a quarter of a century before. The Scramble for Africa started what 1818 and ended in like what 1915, which coincides, funnily enough, with the start of the First World War.
Yeah.
People were literally amassing resources to fight that battle. Not directly necessarily, but indirectly, those things that funded it. And I thought, well, how can you talk about that and not talk about the empire?
Right.
Really. And that to me is an admission that is at best intellectually incomplete and at worst disingenuous.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, I guess it's through education and through listening to people, I guess, and that's the thing. It's like, we need to hear more voices.
The control of narratives of everything.
Right. Yeah. But how do we wrestle? And that's the thing. Like, that's where it's so complicated, because that's like, how do we wrestle those things back? Like, I guess, you know, to a certain extent, you're doing that. I'm trying to do that in a different way, from a different position.
Yeah, because you're trying to articulate, because if a particular demographic has control of a narrative, that's dangerous and it's problematic, because the more you can speak for somebody, it's like Orientalism, right?
Right.
The more you, as Edward Said said, the Orient is produced for, I think, Western consumption. You know, it's produced as in the Western gaze or the male gaze. You know, women are produced for male consumption of visibility. And that's problematic, because the more you have a perception of what something is, and you other people, you've othered them, then you can do whatever you like to them. It's the precursor to abuse.
Yeah.
Of whatever form.
Do you think it works only one way, or do you think it works both directions?
I think that, look, I mean, all these, I think it's a Foucault, I've been starting to read some Foucault in about power dynamics, like every conversation has a power dynamic.
Right.
And, you know, oppressions, I suppose that, yeah, it works the other way, and you know, like, it's like in physics, like every force has an opposite and equal reaction to an extent. But ultimately, like, if a people is oppressed to such an extent, then
it's understandable.
Whatever goes the other direction is not equal. It's not
the anger, the rage is much more understandable. If somebody is rude to you, like, it's much more understandable if they are from a group that's been like treated. But like, I don't understand why people can't see that.
Here's the thing: there's a difference between, I think, a systematic prejudice and a discrimination against an individual.
Right.
So if someone goes, like, for example, Eminem, as a rapper, a young rapper in Detroit, you know, white guy, honky, this is that, you know, and they're really offensive to him. That, to me, is a discrimination, but it's not a systematic, you know, there's not a systematic discrimination in that area by, you know, ultimately, white people in that area, white working class people, will not endure the same levels of police brutality. So absolutely, of course, there's discrimination against white people in these places, or minority, or men might, in a situation, experience discrimination or hostility, but those, I think, would be very difficult for any man to link his discrimination in a particular social circumstance to a wider systemic.
That's interesting, prejudice. Though. I mean, the thing is, because I come from this point of view of trying to listen, right? Because I am you know, I didn't choose to be, but I am a white male straight.
You're what?
I've got everything.
If I'd known
right?
this, I would have left
exactly.
the podcast.
I got everything. Right? I've got like I haven't got mental health, so I've got something on the other side, but not much, right? But I absolutely see all of these arguments, and I absolutely agree that there is this terrible structure that privileges people like me and does not privilege other people, and I absolutely see that. But it's not even a but, though, because I'm reluctant to say the but, because I want that to stand, like that's how I feel. But
at the same time,
at the same time, right? It's yeah, because that's the thing. It's Niels Bohr, right? Like the person I think, like, I mean, okay, yeah, okay, I'm gonna. He's a white guy, but who's partly responsible for the nuclear bomb in the end. But he said this thing about the difference between a truth, like there are a trivial truth and a profound truth, right? The difference is a truth, the opposite of a truth is a lie, a falsehood, right? But a profound truth, the equal, is also equally true, right? And so that's like the theory of, that's what kind of led to the uncertainty principle and the kind of physics element of that stuff. But for me, it has a kind of profound philosophical nature. So like people are wonderful and lovely and the most perfect, like we find wonderful love within people, right? But also we're the worst, right? Those things are both true.
Yeah.
We you know, like those two facts are true. And so when you look at when I think that's true, that is absolutely true, that structurally there is, and I know I'm taking up loads of time now, but I think that structurally it's absolutely fair to say that racism works one way, that sexism works one way. But then there's this other truth that I think also exists, in that when you look at, and gender's my key for this, right? Because for me, like, whilst I see women as massively much more oppressed than men, it's hard for me to see men not being oppressed by gender, like, and feminism accepts this with patriarchy hurts men too, right? They acknowledge that now, and so, like, I think white people are hurt just because we're not making friends. Like, I know this is nothing like fucking slavery, right? Like, but oppressing our basic humanity, oppressing this thing that allows us to see other. I was saying off mic that my gran couldn't see black people as humans. Yeah. That's terrible for those black people, but ultimately that's also terrible for her. That's sad for her. She didn't ever speak to her great grandchild. That's sad for her. Those things are both true. Like, structurally, is one way. Yeah.
Well,
but
I think you make a very important point. I think actually the danger, not the danger, actually, not, that's not fair. It's not fair to your analysis. I think actually the articulation of it that I find more satisfying is that these structures, the harm of these structures is pervasive. The harm, that's true structural violence when it is pervasive. It's not equally harmful to white people or to black men as opposed to women, but it harms everyone because it. This is the danger of the war on empathy I mentioned before. It robs people of a common humanity.
Right.
It robs people of an understanding of the person's position. You know, the demonization. It's one thing to be hated for what you are, but the true pernicious nature of these structural prejudices is to be hated for that which you are not. You know, if I'm black and you hate me for being a bunch of characteristics you think are being, for being black, that to me is abhorrent. Like, you can hate me in a way. I can almost get down to, if you despise me for being who I am, look, I don't have a, any club you walk into, someone's going to think you're a loser or a tosser. That's right. I get that. But to be hated for a bunch of characteristics that I imputed to you, that is just offensive. And everyone loses in that situation. Obviously the black person or the guy or whatever loses, or whoever loses more than
much
others.
Much worse.
But ultimately, like, we all lose there. And it's getting people to see that, you know, as far as you can. And someone said the other day to me, like, about writing and to educate people. And I was like, actually, I don't write to educate people because I don't think, I'm not actually a teacher. If I had a job as a teacher at my class and I was teaching, I'd be like, yes, I'm teaching. And that, I wouldn't feel pretentious or narcissistic saying that. all I can do is put stuff out there and hope it resonates to the extent that people will look at it and be like, this is not a good look for us or any of us.
You see, I mean, because that's that. I mean, yeah, I'm not like looking for you to like even validate my position, because ultimately my position is the people from different classes who structurally, and that's the other thing, like one of the things I think gets left out a lot from analysis is class, but like
it's vital.
You know, and so a lot of the time that is forgotten about when we talk about groups versus other groups, you know. So I think that classism can manifest itself as looking like racism against white people, because like certain elements of class are being despised, and if you know, that becomes a, like, there is a cliche of a certain kind of white person, like a chav, like that word, which I actually don't use and I find to be problematic,
it's
a, right?
It's a disgusting word, yeah.
And but that word is like structurally oppressive to white working class people.
The dark thing about the word chav, it was that, you know, being at a school like Eton, being at Eton, and people using that word, and I was thinking, you don't know any white working class people. So, like, if you've got, like, you know, you have, like, well, white working class friends, you know, I grew up in West Drayton, which is,
right,
like, it's near Heathrow. It's just, it's a white working class town, like, and you'd have mates, and they might call each other chavs or whatever, and that would be because they had, like, the boy races or whatever, or yes, and but it was, like, these things are a term of endearment. It's among friends, like...
Right, it's, well, like, it's a little bit
it's
like...
it's like black people calling each other the M-word.
I'm
like,
glad you said it, because yeah, well, I was like...
I didn't say either.
Right, but you like, referred
but,
to it.
But yeah, because I'm not African-American, so the culture
right,
is different.
Right. But it's a cultural thing, right.
Whereas...
And I grew up with white working class people who might use the word chav about each other, and
yeah,
that's
no,
fine.
Of course, because... But the thing about using the word... For me, I didn't like the word... that's why I didn't like Little Britain to a large extent, because...
Yeah, I hated that.
I hate the character, the Vicky Pollard character was disgusting, because it was basically like, oh yeah, let's just like have a go at like, you know, working class single mums. Yeah. Like, that's basically what that is, Vicky Pollard. I didn't like that show for a lot of reasons. I actually thought it was quite reactionary in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think perpetuated a lot of the problems we see.
I didn't like
the character, the only gay in the village character, because it gave the impression that, like, you know, small towns were post-gay. And they're not, a lot of them. They're really not, a lot of them.
Yeah.
You know, and actually, a guy like that,
no, that's
in
true.
Certain places, might have his head kicked in.
Yeah,
and I didn't like that, because it was like, oh, get over it, you're gay, get over it, or when everyone's secretly gay and everyone's fine, you're the guy that's making a big deal out of it. I didn't like that character at all. I thought it was too easy a get out.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, and it is much more complicated than that. Like, I grew up mostly with white working class people and hung out in white working class areas growing up, and like the way that like. Like that's a thing, like where like white working class culture gets painted with one brush, and it's not those things.
Like,
there are white working class gay people who are friends with, like, they are friends with people. They're not all prejudiced in these ways. It's always said, right?
It's
so complicated.
And it's an argument for plurality. It's not even an argument for like lionizing people from different social classes. It's just like, paint the damn picture.
Yeah,
paint the diversity of it. But of course, that's the thing, lazy comedy, which is what I think a lot of Little Britain is reductive for cheap laughs. And it's basically like, it's formed on the basis, a lot of it's metropolitan complacency. You know, we're living in a nice big city where being gay is fine and passé. Let's project that into the countryside and joke about it.
Right.
And project that reality for all people. Actually, it's really not the reality. Like, I know, you know, there's people I work with and whatever, you know, of teachers in a lot of schools who aren't out.
Right.
Because you can't be openly gay in certain schools because they might be religious or different class background, however being gay is constructed in certain parts of the country. And it's not cool to be out as a teacher. And there are still problems in schools about gay kids getting bullied.
Well, I think it's not acknowledging, like, I mean, the people writing it, one of them is gay, right?
Yeah.
But he's not acknowledging the lived experience of the other people
exactly.
who are gay.
And
a
far better sketch to me would have been somebody who is oblivious, a straight person who has prejudice, who's oblivious to all the gay people around him, who don't tell him or her that they're gay because they know what he's like.
That's nice.
But behind their, oh, so-and-so, oh, they live together down the street. For example, like him going home and talking to his wife, or her talking to her husband. Oh, so-and-so, oh, yeah, those flatmates. And the wife being like, or the husband being like, they've been flatmates for 30 years.
Right.
Join the dots. Or like, oh, so-and-so, I wonder if they're going to meet someone nice and settle down. It's like, and everyone just like shaking their heads as they walk up there. And that's the thing, when you isolate the ignorance is a much more powerful tool, I think.
No, for sure. Right, well, I mean, it's gone time for me to ask you the last question, which is, do you have anything to plug? Which is a sort of strange question. Always strange after we've talked about politics or emotional things. It's always a sort of to bring it down to these kind of...
No. We'll resist the capitalist tendency. I've got nothing to plug, but if you're interested in anything I've got to write, then there's my website, I suppose, which is fancy. So if you want to have a look at anything I've written for further context, then my website is simply okwonga.com, which is okwonga.com.
Yeah.
So you can just check that out if you like.
It's spelt how it sounds.
Absolutely.
And that's your Twitter as well, isn't it?
That's right, my Twitter.
Excellent. The last thing I ask people to do, which is different from the last question, I don't know why I have to say this last thing twice. It's been
annoying. Oh, it was an epilogue.
Yeah, but the last thing I ask people to do is to say goodbye to the audience.
Goodbye, dear audience. Thank you for having me, Dave. Absolute pleasure, and I hope you enjoy what you've heard, and I hope it's a good resonance.
It's been my pleasure. Goodbye, everyone.
So, yeah, there is quite an irony in some ways I found listening back to somebody emphatically stating that they want to listen to other people's stories as a kind of interruption to what somebody else is saying. Life is, in fact, full of many ironies, and there's always things to be working on, and I always have to work on listening to people better, which is why I do this show in the first place. Whilst I'm adding things on at the end, I'd like to remind you guys that old episodes are getting better acquainted, edited into hour-long chunks, are going out on Resonance FM on Fridays at 11 a.m. and on Tuesdays at 2 a.m. That's Resonance 104.4 FM that you can listen to around the South Bank area of London, and also you can listen online at those times too at resonancefm.com. And whilst I'm doing the capitalist thing of plugging, I might as well also plug my other podcast and live show, Stand Up Tragedy. We had a great night of it last Friday doing Tragic Love, and that will start being podcast this week with Tragic Love Act 1, which features Sarah Pascoe, David Lee Morgan, Debree Stevenson, and... yeah, a little bit of me. Stand Up Tragedy is a place where we try to make people cry until they laugh and laugh until they cry. And we ask performers of lots of different kinds, so comedians, musicians, storytellers, spoken word artists, to get up on stage and share some tragedy with our audiences. So you can find that on iTunes, Stitcher, Smart Radio, and on SoundCloud. And our website is www.standuptragedy.co.uk. And as ever, thanks for listening. You can find Getting Better Acquainted on Twitter, at GBA Podcast. You can find it on Facebook. It's Getting Better Acquainted. Have a search on Facebook and like it. Or you can find it on the website, www.gettingbetteracquainted.co.uk. You can also subscribe by searching on iTunes and subscribing to us that way. And on the Stitcher Smart Radio app that you can download for your smartphone from stitcher.com or through the App Store. There are lots of ways to get better acquainted.